This text was prepared by Donald Leinson, CHARLIEDirect. C.com. Little Travels and Roadside Sketches, by Titmarsh, by William Macapus Thackeray. I from Richmond and Surrey to Brussels and Belgium, 2. Ghent Bruges. Ghent 1840, Bruges, 3. Waterloo. Little Travels and Roadside Sketches. I from Richmond and Surrey to Brussels and Belgium, I quitted the Oast Cottage Hotel at Richmond, one of the comfortablest, quietest, cheapest, neatest little inns in England, and a thousand times preferable, in my opinion, to the Tar and Garter, whither, if you go alone, a sneering waiter, with his hair curled, frightens you off the premises, and where, if you are bold enough, to brave the sneering waiter, you have to pay 10 shillings for a bottle of claret, and whence, if you look out of the window, you gaze on a view which is so rich, that it seems to knock you down with its splendor, a view that has its hair curled like the swaggering waiter. I say, I quitted the Oast Cottage Hotel with deep regret, believing that I should see nothing so pleasant as its gardens, and its veal cutlets, and its dear little bowling green, elsewhere. But the time comes when people must go out of town, and so I got on the top of the omnibus, and the carpet bag was put inside. If I were a great prince and rode outside of coaches as I should, if I were a great prince, I would, whether I smoked or not, have a case of the best Havanas in my pocket, not for my own smoking, but to give them to the snobs on the coach, who smoke the vilest cheroots. They poison the air with the odor of their filthy weeds. A man at all easy in his circumstances would spare himself much annoyance by taking the above simple precaution. A gentleman sitting behind me tapped me on the back and asked for a light. He was a footman, or rather valet. He had no livery, but the three friends who accompanied him were tall men in pepper and salt undress jackets with a duke's coronet on their buttons. After tapping me on the back, and when he had finished his cheroot, the gentleman produced another wind instrument, which he called a canopium, a sort of trumpet, on which he showed a great inclination to play. He began puffing out of the canopium a most abominable air, which he said was the Duke's March. It was played by particular request of one of the pepper and salt gentry. The noise was so abominable that even the coachman objected, although my friend's brother footmen were ravished with it, and said that it was not allowed to play tunes on his bus. "Very well," said the valet, "we're only of the Duke of B.S. establishment, that's all." The coachman could not resist that appeal to his fashionable feelings. The valet was allowed to play his infernal canopium, and the poor fellow, the coachman, who had lived in some private families, was quite anxious to conciliate the footman F. the Duke of B.S. establishment, that's all, and told several stories of his having been groom in Captain Hoskins' family, nephew of Governor Hoskins, which stories the footman received with great contempt. The footmen were like the rest of the fashionable world in this respect. I felt for my part that I respected them. They were in daily communication with a duke. They were not the rose, but they had lived beside it. There is an odor in the English aristocracy which intoxicates plebeians. I am sure that any commoner in England, though he would die rather than confess it, would have a respect for those great big hulking duke's footmen. The day before, Her Grace the Duchess had passed us alone in a chariot and four with two outriders. What better mark of innate superiority could man want? Here was a slim lady who required 4-6 horses to herself, and 4 servants. Canopium was, no doubt, one of the number, to garter. We were 16 inside and out, and had consequently an eighth of a horse apiece. A duchess equals 6, a commoner equals 1/8. That is to say, one duchess equals 48 commoners. If I were a duchess of the present day, I would say to the Duke, my noble husband, my dearest Grace, I think, when I travel alone in my chariot from Hammersmith to London, I will not care for the outriders. In these days, when there is so much poverty and so much disaffection in the country, we should not equibuser the canal with the sight of our preposterous prosperity. But this is very likely only plebeian envy, and I dare say, if I were a lovely duchess of the realm, I would ride in a coach and six, with a coronet on the top of my bonnet, and a robe of velvet and ermine even in the dog days. Alas! These are the dog days. Many dogs are abroad, snarling dogs, biting dogs, envious dogs, mad dogs. Beware of exciting the fury of such with your flaming red velvet and dazzling ermine. It makes ragged Lazarus doubly hungry to see dives feasting in cloth of gold. And so if I were a bodious duchess. Silence, vain man. Can the queen herself make you a duchess? Be content then, nor jibe but thy betters of the Duke of B.S. establishment, that's all. On board the Dwerpen, off everywhere. We have bidden adieu to Billingsgate, we have passed the Thames Tunnel, it is 1 o'clock, and of course people are thinking of being hungry. What a merry place a steamer is on a calm sunny summer forenoon, and what an appetite everyone seems to have. We are, I assure you, no less than 170 noblemen and gentlemen together, pacing up and down under the awning, or lolling on the sofas in the cabin, and hardly have we passed Greenwich when the feeding begins. The company was at the brandy and soda water in an instant. There is a sort of legend that the beverage is a preservative against seasickness, and I admired the penetration of gentlemen who partook of the drink. In the first place, the steward will put so much brandy into the tumbler that it is fit to choke you, and secondly, the soda water, being kept as near as possible to the boiler of the engine, is of a fine wholesome heat when presented to the hot and thirsty traveler. Thus he is prevented from catching any sudden cold which might be dangerous to him. The forepart of the vessel is crowded to the full as much as the genteeler quarter. There are 4 carriages, each with piles of imperials and aristocratic gimcracks of travel, under the wheels of which those personages have to clamber who have a mind to look at the bowsprit, and perhaps to smoke a cigar at ease. The carriages overcome, you find yourself confronted by a huge penful of Durham oxen, lying on hay and surrounded by a barricade of oars. 15 of these horned monsters maintain an incessant mooing and bellowing. Beyond the cows, come a heap of cotton bags, beyond the cotton bags more carriages, more pyramids of traveling trunks, and valets and couriers bustling and swearing round about them. And already, and in various corners and niches, lying on coils of rope, black tar cloths, ragged cloaks, hey, you see a score of those dubious 4 cabin passengers, who are never shaved, who always look unhappy, and appear getting ready to be sick. At 1, dinner begins in the after cabin: boiled salmon, boiled beef, boiled mutton, boiled cabbage, boiled potatoes, and parboiled wine for any gentleman who like it, and 2 roast ducks between 70. After this, knobs of cheese are handed round on a plate, and there is a talk of a tart somewhere at some end of the table. All this I saw peeping through a sort of meat safe which ventilates the top of the cabin, and very happy and hot did the people seem below. How the deuce can people dine at such an hour, say several genteel fellows who are watching the maneuvers. Can't touch a morsel before 7. But somehow at 3:30 we had dropped a long way down the river. The air was delightfully fresh, the sky of a faultless cobalt, the river shining and flashing like quicksilver, and at this period steward runs against me bearing 2 great smoking dishes covered by 2 great glistening hemispheres of tin. Fellow, says I, what's that? He lifted up the cover. It was ducks and green peas, by jingo. What? Haven't they done yet, the greedy creatures? I asked. Have the people been feeding for 3 hours? Law bless you, sir, it's the second dinner. Make haste, or you won't get a place. At which words a genteel party, with whom I had been conversing, instantly tumbled down the hatchway, and I find myself one of the second relay of 70 who are attacking the boiled salmon, boiled beef, boiled cabbage, and sea. As for the ducks, I certainly had some peas, very fine yellow stiff peas, that ought to have been split before they were boiled, But, with regard to the ducks, I saw the animals gobbled up before my eyes by an old widow lady and her party just as I was shrieking to the steward to bring a knife and fork to carve them. The fellow, I mean the widow lady's whiskered companion, I saw a meat piece with the very knife with which he had dissected the duck. After dinner, as I need not tell the keen observer of human nature who peruses this, the human mind, if the body be in a decent state, expands into gaiety and benevolence, and the intellect longs to measure itself in friendly converse with the divers intelligences around it. We ascend upon deck, and after eyeing each other for a brief space, and with a friendly modest hesitation, we begin anon to converse about the weather, and other profound and delightful themes of English discourse. We confide to each other our respective opinions of the ladies round about us. Look at that charming creature in a pink bonnet, and a dress of the pattern of a Kilmarnock snuffbox. A stalwart Irish gentleman in a green coat and bushy red whiskers is whispering something very agreeable into her ear, as is the wont of gentlemen of his nation, for her dark eyes kindle, her red lips open, and give an opportunity to a dozen beautiful pearly teeth to display themselves, and glance brightly in the sun, while round the teeth and the lips a number of lovely dimples make their appearance, and her whole countenance assumes a look of perfect health and happiness. See her companion in shot silk and a dove-colored parasol, in what a graceful Watteau-like attitude she reclines. The tall courier who has been bouncing about the deck in attendance upon these ladies, it is his first day of service, and he is eager to make a favorable impression on them, and the ladies' maids too, has just brought them from the carriage a small paper of sweet cakes. Nothing is prettier than to see a pretty woman eating sweet biscuits, and a bottle that evidently contains Malmsey Madeira. How daintily they sip it, how happy they seem. How that lucky rogue of an Irishman prattles away. Yonder is a noble group indeed. An English gentleman and his family. Children, mother, grandmother, grown-up daughters, father, and domestics, 22 in all. They have a table to themselves on the deck, and the consumption of eatables among them is really endless. The nurses have been bustling to and fro, and bringing, first, slices of cake, then dinner, then tea with huge family jugs of milk, and the little people have been playing hide, and seek round the deck, coquetting with the other children, and making friends of every soul on board. I love to see the kind eyes of women fondly watching them as they gamble about. A female face, be it ever so plain, when occupied in regarding children, becomes celestial almost, and a man can hardly fail to be good and happy while he is looking on at such sights. H, sir, says a great big man, whom you would not accuse of sentiment, I have a couple of those little things at home, and he stops, and heaves a great big sigh, and swallows down a half tumbler of cold something and water. We know what the honest fellow means well enough. He is saying to himself, God bless my girls and their mother. But, being a Briton, is too manly to speak out in a more intelligible way. Perhaps it is as well for him to be quiet, and not chatter, and gesticulate like those Frenchmen a few yards from him, who are chirping over a bottle of champagne. There is, as you may fancy, a number of such groups on the deck, and a pleasant occupation it is for a lonely man to watch them, and build theories upon them, and examine those two personages seated cheek by jowl. One is an English youth, traveling for the first time, who has been hard at his guidebook during the whole journey. He has an annual du voyageur in his pocket. A very pretty, amusing little oblong work it is too, and might be very useful, if the foreign people in three languages, among whom you travel, would but give the answer set down in the book, or understand the questions you put to them out of it. The other honest gentleman in the fur cap, what can his occupation be? We know him at once for what he is. Says he, in a fine German accent, I am a professor of languages, and will give you lessons in Danish, Swedish, English, Portuguese, Spanish and Persian. Thus occupied in meditations, the rapid hours and the rapid steamer pass quickly on. The sun is sinking, and, as he drops, the ingenious luminary sets the Thames on fire. Several worthy gentlemen, watch in hand, are eagerly examining the phenomena attending his disappearance. Rich clouds of purple and gold, that form the curtains of his bed, little barks that pass black across his disc every instant dropping nearer and nearer into the water. Here he goes, says one sagacious observer. Oh, he doesn't, cries another. Now he is gone, and the steward is already threading the deck, asking the passengers, right and left, if they will take a little supper. What a grand object is a sunset, and what a wonder is an appetite at sea. Lo! The horned moon shines pale over Margate, and the red beacon is gleaming from distant Ramsgate Pier. A great rush is speedily made for the mattresses that lie in the boat at the ship's side. And as the night is delightfully calm, many fair ladies and worthy men determine to couch on deck for the night. The proceedings of the former, especially if they be young and pretty, the philosopher watches with indescribable emotion and interest. What a number of pretty coquetries do the ladies perform, and into what pretty attitudes do they take care to fall? All the little children have been gathered up by the nursery maids, and are taken down to roost below. Balmy sleep seals the eyes of many tired wayfarers, as you see in the case of the Russian nobleman asleep among the portmanteaus, and Titmarsh, who has been walking the deck for some time with a great mattress on his shoulders, knowing full well that were he to relinquish it for an instant, some other person would seize on it, now stretches his bed. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.